Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How dangerous could a single molecule possibly be? Scientists are well aware of the existential hazards of certain viruses, bacteria, fungi, and parasites. But an emerging field of medical research suggests there may be a new deadly culprit to blame for some of what ails us. Mutant proteins called prions that don't even contain genetic material, yet appear to be responsible for illnesses like mad cow and its human iteration Creutzfeldt-Jakob, chronic wasting disease, and possibly even Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and ALS. Jay Ingram has spent years tracing the latest research. He's a science writer and broadcaster who co-hosted and produced Discovery Channel Canada's show Daily Planet for 16 years. His new book is called Fatal Flaws: How a Misfolded Protein Baffled Scientists and Changed the Way We Look at the Brain. Jay, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I was going to start by asking you to describe what prions are, but first maybe talk about what proteins are and the function that they serve in living bodies.
Yeah, it's actually a good choice on your part because it's hard to plunge right into prions. So, you know, when we think of our bodies, we sort of think of muscle and fat and water and blood and stuff like that. But in most of those, certainly in muscle and in blood and all of our tissues, the major things are proteins. They sort of build the structures. So your fingernails, for instance, are actually pretty much pure keratin protein. They facilitate every single chemical reaction that goes on in your body. I mean, you know, without protein, living things would be very, very different than they are today, even if they could exist.
Okay, so what are prions, and why are they only recently becoming a major subject of study?
The second part of that really is they were mysterious for a long time because people could hardly bring themselves to believe that they actually were what they really are. Mm-hmm. So just to go back to proteins quickly, these are sort of, if you descend way down to the molecular level, these are actually long chains, but they're folded up, they're coiled up in a way that allows them to do whatever they're supposed to do. So prions, there is actually a natural protein found largely in our brains that performs some role that's not totally clear yet, but it sits there on the surface of our brain cells, and it's folded in a particular way, and it's thought that it kind of moves things in and out of the cell. But these same proteins, which are apparently essential to us, can be folded in a different way. Scientists call it misfolded. And when they're in that conformation, they cause disease. And so it's the sort of the same protein everybody listening to this has in their brains, except it's been folded into a different and fatal shape.
So I think we can understand and follow you that if they get folded into a different shape, they don't do what they're supposed to do. The remarkable thing here is that although these are not living things at the molecular level, am I right about that?
Yeah, they're not living things,
okay.
Definitely.
There's no RNA, no DNA. How do they manage to replicate themselves to infect other protein molecules around them?
Yeah, so, you know, I've over time sort of decided that if you think of recruitment, it's a better way of thinking about it. So that, you know, let's take the mad cow epidemic in the UK, one of the results of which was some, to this date, 170 to 180 people in the UK have died because they ate meat that contained these misfolded mad cow prions. So, you know, thousands and thousands ate meat, only 170 have died. But here's what happens. They eat it, so they've got some mad cow prions in their stomachs. Somehow those escape the stomach, get into the nervous system, go up, and eventually end up in the brain. So now you've got a small invasion of misfolded prions. But whenever they contact normal ones that are already sitting there in the brain, they flip the normal ones into this misfolded form. So you can say they're reproducing, but that doesn't really capture it. It's that they're changing normal ones into ones like themselves. And so the number of prions in the brain starts to escalate dramatically as the normal version gets flipped over. So and eventually you end up with a brain that ceases to function because there are so many prions in it.
So it's almost like one bad apple spoils the bunch.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's not so far from the truth in that it was calculated during the mad cow epidemic in the UK, where you're talking like hundreds of thousands of cows being infected and millions being slaughtered and so on, that at first they thought a peppercorn's worth of prions would kill a cow, but then they revised that dramatically downward from that. So, you know, maybe a quarter of a peppercorn or something. So, you know, what was happening in the UK was cows would die and they'd be recycled into feed that was given to cows. And so, given that a cow can have mad cow and not yet be showing symptoms and so wouldn't be noticed, they were getting sent to the slaughterhouse, processed into human food, but also other ones were being recycled, parts of them, the parts that they don't usually feed to us, were being recycled and put into cattle feed and infecting cows exponentially.
Does cooking make a difference?
No. You have to know, because, you know, you think of what were the major meat products. It would have been burgers, sausages, mm-hmm. meat pies, all that kind of stuff. So cooked at normal oven, whatever temperatures or barbecue you use for that. The thing about prions, and it's not just mad cow prions, but all of them, they're incredibly resistant. You know, there have been horrifying cases of the human version, as you mentioned in the intro, Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, being transmitted through, let's say, electrodes that were put into people's brains. And even though they sterilized the electrodes by the standard surgical means, it wasn't enough. Hmm. Prions survived, and if we get to chronic wasting disease, the thing there is that the live migrating animals are shedding these prions into the environment through almost every route you can imagine.
Well, let's talk about that, because chronic wasting disease actually affects a number of different wild animals that sort of move through nature, and it appears to be zoonotic, at least across certain species in the wild.
Yeah. Well, and actually, I guess it was just in 2012 that the first cases were confirmed in Texas, in very, you know, way out in the west by the Pecos River. But, you know, it's in 20 states now, two Canadian provinces. The thing about this disease, the thing about chronic wasting disease that sets us apart from anything else is that it's now in wild animals. Mad cow disease never spread to wild animals. None of the others, scrapie is a prion disease in sheep. It doesn't spread outside of sheep as far as anybody knows. So those are all domestic animals, but chronic wasting, although it started in a mule deer research establishment in Colorado in the 60s, at least that's when it was first noticed, it's now in wild mule deer, wild white-tailed deer, elk, and moose. And, you know, it spreads in weird ways. If you look at the map of Texas and see, okay, you've got this little cluster down on the New Mexico border in the south, but then there's a pretty huge distance between there and Colorado, which is the next place where you actually have infected animals. You know, and honestly, Chris, almost any question is worth asking in this disease. It can't be an actual gap. How would the prions get from, say, Colorado to, you know, South Texas? There has to be an animal that brought them somehow. And, you know, deer can go a long way in their lives, and if these diseases are always very slow incubation, so from the time you actually catch the prions to the time you die, if you're a white-tailed deer, it could be 3 years or 4 years. They can cover a lot of ground, and it comes out in their saliva, comes out in their urine. If they die, gets from their bones into the ground, it lasts for years in the ground. You can see the issues.
So this appears to be infectious, obviously, Jay, but when you say any questions worth asking, is it possible that it spontaneously appears because of some environmental factor?
Yeah, well, that's a very... That is a good question. It's not considered... How can I put this? I don't think any prion scientist would deny the possibility of spontaneous, because in humans, Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease strikes usually people over 60, and about a million, one in a million per year. So in the U.S., I guess that would mean like, you know, 350 cases or something.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no known, some of them are familial, they have a genetic predisposition, but the vast majority of them just seem to get it.
Mm-hmm.
And people have wondered, well, you know, could maybe somehow the sheep version be secretly, covertly infecting humans? But, you know, Australia doesn't have any scrapie, the prion disease in sheep, and yet they have their normal load of people getting Creutzfeldt-Jakob. So if it's spontaneous in humans, could it be spontaneous in, say, deer? Well, you know, like I say, nobody would say no, but I don't think it's top of mind for most scientists. They can pretty much see how it gets from animal to animal.
So let's talk about the earliest appearance of what seems to be a prion disease in humans when certain residents of New Guinea were stricken by this horrible cascade of symptoms.
This is one of the most sensational stories, not just sort of sensational because it involves cannibalism, but sensational because it really burst upon the scientific scene. So in the mid-50s, when Australians began to move into New Guinea after the Second, well, they started after the Second World War, but once they became fairly well established, there were reports coming out of this disease called kuru, which affected only one relatively small group of people in the eastern highlands of New Guinea. But it was a horrible disease. They gradually lost control of mobility and their muscles. Eventually, they couldn't stand up, and eventually they would basically curl up and die. And for almost all of the course of that disease, they were mentally intact. So it was, you know, particularly horrible. Mm-hmm. Hotshot doctors came in, including one, Carlton Gajusek, that eventually won the Nobel Prize for this, came in, tried to figure out, said it was hopeless, because it didn't look like an infection. These people who were stricken by kuru had no fever, no signs of inflammation, nothing that said to doctors in the mid-50s, and even now, this is an infection. So they kind of dismissed that idea and were wondering about toxins in the soil or whatever. And finally, it was an anthropologist, really, who came up, you know, looked at the data and decided, you know, started discouraging cannibalism at the end of the 50s, and they stopped doing it because, I should fill in this piece, this particular group practiced funeral banquets when somebody in the family died. And so as part of the after-death ceremony, they would basically carve up and cook the dead individual.
And let me interrupt you. People think this is like, I mean, cannibalism is always going to be disturbing, but this was meant to be a sign of respect for
the disease. Yeah, absolutely. It wasn't the kind of cannibalism that, say, the Aztecs carried out, where you basically, you know, beat somebody in battle and chop them up and eat them. This was, as you said, this was a reverent activity and actually probably makes a lot of sense. But the thing that was curious about it was, and of course the brain was eaten, and mm-hmm. given that we now know that kuru was a prion disease, these people were absolutely directly infecting themselves. But it took a while for people to accept that cannibalism played the key role, because again, it didn't look like an infection, and that's what cannibalism would foster. Anyway, turned out that once cannibalism stopped, then you started seeing fewer and fewer and eventually no young children getting it, because they used to, because they were at those feasts. And then you started seeing no more teenagers, and it gradually moved up through the ages.
Jay Ingram is with us. His new book is called Fatal Flaws: How a Misfolded Protein Baffled Scientists and Changed the Way We Look at the Brain. We'll be back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where you can design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, global studies, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with science author and broadcaster Jay Ingram. His new book is called Fatal Flaws: How a Misfolded Protein Baffled Scientists and Changed the Way We Look at the Brain. Join the conversation by emailing think at kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. So, Jay, just about everybody who contracted Kuru, who showed symptoms, died, but not everybody got sick. What might account for that?
Well, you know, I'm not sure that that's actually right. I think everybody that did get Kuru and was at least accurately diagnosed as having Kuru eventually died. What did happen, though, and maybe this is what you're getting at, is that even though cannibalism stopped by 1960 in Papua New Guinea among these people, there were deaths from Kuru that continued through time. And the most recent one that I know of was in 2005. I mean, 2005, that's, you know, like 45 years after cannibalism stopped. So this woman probably had attended a funeral feast 2 or 3 years earlier. So let's say, basically, she'd been incubating this disease for 50 years and finally died in 2005. And it makes you wonder whether there still might be some others. And it's kind of typical of human prion disease that different genetic types, and there's sort of one specific place in the human genome, in the prion, in the gene for the prion protein that's critical, certain people are more resistant to these diseases than others. So when you look at the UK after the mad cow epidemic and you see that 170, 171 people have died, I think every one of those people, maybe all but one, have the same genetic type. So they could be seen to be the most susceptible. And then you got to wonder, they represent about a third of the British population. Then you got to wonder about, you know, the other two genetic types. How much more resistant to this disease might they be if they're already carrying the prions?
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Michael in Dallas. Hi, Michael.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
So I've been doing some research recently on a prion disease called fatal familial insomnia. And I've read that this disease is actually inherited. And so I'm wondering how these prion diseases can be both inherited and also contagious, like you've mentioned.
So contagious is you ingest it one way or the other. I think we've kind of covered that. It's a good question, though. You know, how can they be genetic? Well, the thing is that people with the genetic predisposition to a prion disease have this powerful and sometimes inevitable mechanism that actually allows their normal prion proteins to spontaneously misfold. And so I'm not sure. I think everybody that gets fatal familial insomnia, I guess by the name, dies, as is the case with all prion diseases. What I don't know is that if everybody has that particular genetic change, do they die? I think they do. So the thing is, it's just that you're inevitably going to create your own misfolded proteins. They don't have to come from outside. And that might be what's going on with Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, that one in a million disease worldwide. Is it just those individuals somehow spontaneously create misfolded prions, which then turn against them?
So tell us about Stanley Prusiner, one of the sort of pioneers in saying this is real and this deserves serious research.
Yeah, Stan Prusiner was the guy who coined the term prion, although it actually is the name of a bird that flies in the southern oceans. But anyway, it's he coined the name. He actually encountered quite a bit of pushback about that because he's in San Francisco. English researchers who'd been working on the sheep disease scrapie for decades felt that this was a bit of an upstart move for somebody that they didn't really know much about in San Francisco, deciding he was going to call these objects prions. Anyway, he created a huge stir when he published that idea in 1982, And he started making the case strongly for the idea that this was a protein-only infectious agent. He couldn't afford to say absolutely 100% because at that time, 30 years ago, there was still some chance that there might be some stray bits of DNA that nobody had found before. But he was pretty clearly, if you read his paper in Science from then, pretty clearly making the case that this is a protein-only thing. I'm calling them prions, and I think they're going to be hugely significant. And, you know, in all of those, he turns out to have been right.
Hmm. We have an email here.
So he was the second. So Guy Jacek from New Guinea won the first Nobel Prize associated with prions. Stan Prusiner won the second.
We have an email here from Stephen in Denton who says, given that prions are proteins without normal tertiary structure, have antibodies been utilized as an indicator of their presence or a potential portion of treatment?
Antibodies are being investigated as a mode of defending one against prions. Interestingly, and this takes a little bit of a leap, but we can go back over this, there are also misfolded proteins, technically not prions, in other diseases like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, Lou Gehrig's disease, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, and so on. And they're misfolded proteins, and they aggregate, as they do in the prion diseases. And so there actually is a Canadian research group who are moving a couple of antibodies that they've developed into the beginning trials to see if, at least in Alzheimer's disease, can antibodies recognize, remove, disaggregate, do whatever you have to do to these misfolded proteins in Alzheimer's, which cause the things called plaques. So antibodies are a possible route. You know, the real issue is none of these diseases, even chronic wasting disease, which now is the biggest biomass of prions anywhere in the world, and it's spreading, but it's not spreading incredibly rapidly, and it covers such a wide geographic area that in things like that, like people would like to develop a vaccine against chronic wasting disease to limit the spread of the disease, but just finding the deer that are, you know, where, how far have the deer gone with the prion, and we certainly can't vaccinate every animal, and so you get into these kinds of issues.
So how is it that these other diseases that involve misfolded proteins that can aggregate are still separate technically from prion diseases?
Well, you know, it depends in a way who you are, because Stan Prusiner published a paper this past summer where he called the plaques of Alzheimer's, or the misfolded proteins of Parkinson's, he called them prions. This was funny because the New England Journal of Medicine, in an editorial right around that time, maybe even a bit before, had urged scientists not to call them prions because they didn't want people thinking that Alzheimer's was an infectious disease. And if you start calling the plaques of Alzheimer's prion-like, or the misfolded proteins prion-like, then people are going to make that association. And in fact, there was a meeting in Scotland last November. The title of the day's meeting was, Is Alzheimer's Disease Infectious? I can tell you the short answer coming out of that was, no, we have no evidence for that. But you know, Chris, here's the thing. Like, my mother had Alzheimer's disease, so I spent, you know, a reasonable amount of time with her when she had it. Let's say I did catch it from her, but let's say I was only 25 when that happened, or 35, and I'd cared for my grandmother, and then I get Alzheimer's when I'm 85. Who would ever associate my getting it at 85 with the fact that I spent time with, you know, a relative 40 or 50 years earlier? You wouldn't. So the people who look at this say, well, you know, like, it's like almost anything else in science. You can't say 100% Alzheimer's is not infectious, but we have no evidence that it is, and gathering that evidence would be just incredibly difficult. Because, you know, you'd have to do an epidemiological survey that lasted 50 or 60 years or something.
So is the current thinking, Jay, that prions become present in the body by whatever mechanism, and if the diseases caused by them usually manifest themselves late in life, that they lay dormant for a long time, or that they initially sort of convert those other those other proteins around them slowly, and that it takes a long time for critical mass to build up? What's the thinking?
I would say that in most cases, and I would say like scrapie in sheep, mad cow disease in cows, the human version, variant Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease in humans, chronic wasting disease, the feeling is that the very long time between acquiring the prions and showing the symptoms is simply just what you said. It takes a long time to move through the body to the brain, and it takes a relatively long time to recruit enough normal ones into the misfolded form that you actually start to see changes. But, the, you know, also in there, though, that business about lying dormant, I think you used that word. Again, when you, you know, I'm quite interested in, I don't know a huge amount about the normal human Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, the one that's one in a million. But it is intriguing, right, that it seems to pop up with pretty good regularity, although there are some countries like India that report a much lower frequency of CJD. I think those figures have to be, you know, replicated. But, you know, it's basically one in a million. There don't seem to be, I don't know of any predisposing factors like smoking or obesity or diabetes or anything like that. So it's a mystery where those come from, or why, if it just happens in your brain spontaneously, that, you know, you get older and your normal prions just sort of say, oh, forget it, and they misfold. Is it just that that takes 60 years?
Hmm.
The weird thing is that the data all show that once you hit 70, your risk for CJD starts to decline. Again, nobody knows why.
So maybe if you've made it that far, it's not going to happen.
That would, if I, by the time I get to 80, if I don't have CJD, I'm going to assume I'm not going to get it, because I'll be worrying much more about Alzheimer's at that point.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk about that. I mean, my understanding is that you can't, Alzheimer's is diagnosed by the symptoms, but in a living person, it's not possible to take a tissue sample that sort of confirms the
yeah.
presence of the disease. Is that the case for most prion diseases?
No, I think that the set of setting aside Kuru, which really doesn't, you know, except as I said, maybe one or two individuals left, really doesn't exist anymore, and it was mostly a motor disease. The ones that affect the brain, like the like CJD or variant CJD or fatal familial insomnia. Sorry, I forget the question now.
The question was. Fell out of my head as well. It'll come back to me in just a second. Hang on, but we'll move on here.
Okay.
We have an email from Daniel in Dallas who wants to know, are there any known cases of cancerous cells producing prions or prion-like chemicals with clinical consequences?
I've never heard of that. Hmm. Not to say that it might happen, but I've not heard of that, and I don't know of any researchers that might be researching any kind of connection between various cancers and prion diseases. They seem to be independent.
And my earlier question was actually about clinical diagnosis of prion diseases and whether you need a cadaver to sort of confirm the presence of
these. Oh, okay, sorry, yeah. And so what I was going to answer was maybe in the early stages they can be confused with other, say, kinds of dementia. But it's pretty clear by the time the patient succumbs that it's CJD that they were dealing with. However, I would say this, that there was a study in the late 90s suggesting that as much as 14% of people whose death certificate says Alzheimer's might actually have had CJD. And this was the result of a group in Yale doing, you know, lots and lots of brain dissections at autopsy.
Hmm.
But in general, so that's a figure that sits out there. It's a bit controversial. But in general, once you're well into the throes of the disease, you can distinguish CJD from from Alzheimer's. This is an issue, by the way, Chris, when you sort of think about a disease like chronic wasting disease in deer and elk, and then you think of all the hunters who routinely shoot, kill, and eat deer, and it's quite conceivable that, especially if they're hunting in areas that where CWD is known to exist, it's conceivable they're killing a deer and then eating it that actually has those prions in it. So the question is, well, are we susceptible? And this is where the diagnosis issue becomes really critical, because there was a cluster of supposed Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease in the western United States a few years ago. And when I say cluster, it was like, you know, three or four or five cases, mm-hmm. all of which seemed unusual because people were dying of CJD at earlier ages than they should, like 40s and 50s, maybe even late 30s. And in three or four of these people, there was some trace to eating venison, or I think maybe elk in one case. And so it looked suspicious, right? They're all in a short period of time. They've all at one point eaten a suit. But when they really look carefully at the stats, that sort of apparent close association kind of just vanishes. That, you know, one case, the meat was like when she was a kid 25 years ago or something. And so there's never been a case identified of a human catching chronic wasting disease. And the experimental data, which is a bit tricky to do, because you're not experimenting on humans, you're just taking mice and genetically engineering them to resemble humans, that data seems to suggest we're not susceptible. And that would be nice, right? Because that could be a huge, as I said, it's in 20 different states now.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. The email address is think@kera.org. We're speaking this hour with Jay Ingram, who co-hosted and produced Discovery Channel Canada's show Daily Planet for 16 years. He is a science author who's written a book called Fatal Flaws: How a Misfolded Protein Baffled Scientists and Changed the Way We Look at the Brain. We'll come back to our conversation in a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where you can design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, global studies, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Jay Ingram, who is the author of a new book called Fatal Flaws: How a Misfolded Protein Baffled Scientists and Changed the Way We Look at the Brain. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. We actually had a question via email, Jay, about whether or not you eat wild game.
I would, yeah, I do. I don't eat it that often, but that doesn't mean anything. If I were offered it, and I was pretty sure where it came from, I would eat it. You know, I was working in radio in the 80s during the midst of the mad cow outbreak, and the program I worked with, we used to go to England for 2 weeks every year to gather interviews. And so in Canada, I can't give blood now because I was there, presumably exposed to the mad cow prions in the meat I was eating. And I forget, I think it's like if you spend at least 2 weeks for a certain number of years. So I can only hope that if I am incubating it, it's going to take 80 years and I'll die of something else first. But, you know, I'm not afraid of eating elk, or venison, but I think, I know that, there's a containment sort of effort underway in West Texas right now, where, you know, one of the key things is to sort of try and keep track of the deer population as much as possible and prevent them from moving. Hmm. And that includes, like, humans shipping them or just letting deer go from your from where you've raised them into the wild or things like that. I mean, I think it's a really slow burning fuse, chronic wasting disease. But if you speed it up and you look at how it's been spreading, despite people's best efforts, I think there's reason for concern. I'll just tell you one quick reason in Canada. It's moving up in the provinces of Alberta and Saskatchewan. If it gets far enough north, then the prions of chronic wasting disease or animals carrying them are going to intersect with the great caribou migration that, you know, is kind of the scale of wildebeest in Africa. It's mm-hmm. gigantic. Hundreds of thousands of animals moving east and west across sort of, you know, just south of the Arctic. So another big question is, are caribou susceptible? And these take a long time, these experiments, right? You vaccinate three animals or four animals, and you got to wait 3 or 4 years. Anyway, the first results suggest that they might be. One animal did come down with chronic wasting disease in an experiment, but two others didn't. So maybe it's a certain subset of caribou. But I can tell you, Chris, if the caribou herd, the major caribou herd, on which you know, most Aboriginal people living in that part of Canada depend on, if it started to be hit, it would be a disaster. Anyway, long answer, but the short answer to that question is, yeah, I eat meat, but I would want to know, I'd be happy to know exactly where it came from and that area was not yet affected.
What kinds of ideas have been explored that theoretically might be employed to stop the progress of prion aggregation?
Yeah, it's really, that's a tricky question, and of course, going back to when we were talking about Alzheimer's, if you sort of see the deposition of plaque material in Alzheimer's disease, in Alzheimer's patients' brains, as being similar, then that question's even more pertinent to that. You know, how do you prevent that stuff from aggregating? And, you know, one of the issues here is that there's obviously not the effort to curb prion diseases as there is to cure Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and so on, just because the numbers are so different. I mean, if Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease is one in a million, well, you know, that's not a huge medical priority. When it comes to chronic wasting disease, there are big efforts to develop a vaccine which would enable the animal to generate antibodies against misfolded prions that enter its body somehow. The issue is, like I sort of hinted at before, you've got this expanding wavefront of animals, some of them going 100 kilometers in a year, some of them not, some of them shedding the virus on the ground and everywhere else, or visiting a salt lick and leaving prions on the salt lick with its tongue, and the next year gets infected, that it's just so hard to know where the advancing edge is. And, you know, how far should you go to vaccinate? How can you possibly vaccinate every living deer in a huge geographic area? So the issues are different for both the human prion diseases and the animal prion diseases. But I think where the big attention is going to be paid over the next few years is, what are the similarities between prion diseases and the big neurodegenerative ones that we care so much about? And can what we've learned about prions help us treat those others?
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Flo, calling from Maine. Hi, Flo.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi.
You can call me Flo. Name is Felix. Anyway.
Oh, Felix. Oh, so I guess we have your name wrong. Hi, Felix.
Great. Hey, question is, I have read before that prion was an incomplete protein, and now you're calling it a folded protein.
Yeah, it's not incomplete. It is the full-up version of the normal one, but it's been folded into a different shape. And that is the essential problem. So I don't know why anyone would call it incomplete. It doesn't work anymore, but that's because it's been misfolded.
Could prions help explain autoimmune diseases, things like type 1 diabetes and lupus?
I don't think they explain them, although, you know, there. I think type juvenile diabetes also has aggregates of misfolded protein, so there's a connection there. But no, they don't. They really, you know, it's hard for the immune system to recognize them, and I guess that's pretty obvious from saying that, you know, if you were living in Britain in the 80s and you ate a sausage that contained some prions, it would take years for those prions to get into your brain. And during that interval, you'd think, well, surely the immune system would recognize that these things were foreign. One of the tricky bits of biology is that a misfolded prion protein and the normal one, as far as the immune system are concerned, are pretty much the same thing. You know, they haven't changed their sequence of subunits. They react chemically in different ways because of their different folding. And so if you're going to encourage the immune system to develop antibodies, it has to be very carefully designed so that you can actually select a piece of the molecule that is indeed foreign. But, you know, it is striking, isn't it, that, you know, they can be in your body for years and your immune system basically ignores them.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Jack on the line now in Fort Worth. Hi, Jack.
Hi. I wanted to ask the guest if he was aware of the research showing concentrations or cluster groups of KYD in human populations surrounding slaughterhouses like Amarillo, where they're getting cases, you know, case statistics higher than 6 per million. And also if he could address the prion diseases that have been proven by British studies to be transferable from one animal to the next, and even from a cow to a calf via, you know, milk and eating downer animals that the brain tissue is crushed up in. And I'll listen off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
So going backwards, downer animals have always been a problem. They may not, these are animals that simply can't get up. And I'm sure in the past that many of them had or might have had mad cow disease, but they weren't diagnosed as such. The transmission of prions mother to offspring by mother's milk, to my knowledge, has never been unambiguously demonstrated. And it was not an issue in mad cow disease. And then the first question about the people working around slaughterhouses like in Amarillo, and I get heightened cases of, I guess, CJD. I don't know that specific example of around Amarillo, but it sounds a lot like the thing that I was talking about before, where you get a little cluster of unusual CJD, and it looks like it's significant. But to date, when those have been analyzed scientifically, and you could show, like, if you were suspicious that people working near slaughterhouses had say, the human version of mad cow rather than normal human Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, you could analyze their brains at autopsy and figure that out. So I think there's a pretty easy route to deciding whether these people are just odd statistical clustering of CJD, which it could be, or whether they're really actually contracting a prion from somewhere.
And with regard to downer cows, the cows that can't get up, I mean, everyone understands that an animal that is visibly sick needs to be sort of removed and not processed for food. But as you mentioned earlier, Jay, there may be animals walking around that show no sign of illness and yet could be infected.
Well, that's exactly how the epidemic in the UK started. It was in about 1984 that vets were first alerted to, and I'm not kidding here when I say, like, two or three cows that were showing symptoms. Well, you know, from what we know about mad cow now, so those animals probably contracted the disease in 1980, at least that much earlier, maybe even earlier than that. Well, and all that time, they would have been, their spare parts, unfit for human consumption, would have been processed into meat and bone meal and given back to cows. So you can easily see why the beginnings of such an epidemic went kind of unnoticed. Because even the symptoms, they couldn't understand the symptoms, so they just put it down as, you know, an odd case here and an odd case there. And then it actually literally exploded in numbers. I mean, you know, one of the interesting and I think puzzling things about mad cow disease in North America is that we've had 18 cases in Canada with a cattle herd that's, I think, a tenth the size of the national herd in the United States. And yet in the U.S. there's only really been, there was one case that was actually an imported Canadian cow, so we were guilty on that one too. And then two others, and the two others are not even the sort of standard version of mad cow disease. So it's puzzling because I think the feed practices were more or less similar across the border. So, you know, there's still, even about mad cow, which is not a big issue now, even with mad cow, there are some interesting mysteries.
Where's the money coming from, Jay, to do research into these prion diseases?
Well, I can give you a pretty specific example for where I live in Canada, the province of Alberta, because when the first Canadian incident of mad cow disease was discovered, the beef industry in this province, which is considerable, collapsed, like went from billions to zero, because every country closed their borders to Canadian cows. Mm-hmm. So the government immediately sponsored or kicked in money to start a prion research institute. And nationally in Canada, the federal government did the same. And so for, you know, the last 7 or 8 years, most of the momentum here, and I'm not sure, you know, there's always been funding in the U.S. for the human versions because it's part of National Institutes of Health interest, and I'm sure there was response in the cattle industry in the U.S. as well. But most of, you know, the most intense research has been sparked by the mad cow epidemic, whether it was in the U.K. and then didn't have an epidemic in Canada, but we had a number of cases. What I think is going to happen now is that research money for prion disease research is going to have is going to take the angle, what can we learn from prions that will teach us something about Alzheimer's and all those others?
Do you think prion will be a household word within a few years in a way that it's not today?
Nope. I do not.
Despite this fabulous book, really?
Well, you know, it's as a science writer, you know, you quite often have to face the reality that in your local newspaper, the science section ranks below about 17 others.
Mm-hmm.
And so within the realm of science writing, you write a book about prions, a word that scarcely any people even have heard, you are not anticipating being on the New York Times bestseller list. However, you know, I think, like, my background's biology, mm-hmm. I think they biologically are really one of the most interesting, most fascinating things that's happened in biology in the last quarter century. And I think going forward, it's going to be totally fascinating to see how much of how we understand now that, that proteins can misfold and can cause others to misfold and how that can spread from cell to cell in the brain. That stuff's going to be invaluable, I think.
Jay Ingram's new book is Fatal Flaws, How a Misfolded Protein Baffled Scientists and Changed the Way We Look at the Brain. Jay, keep up the good fight. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Chris.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can send comments to think@kera.org. And I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.